rules. They are not so base-minded, said he, but that they would willingly do it. Many of them have already done it by their books, if those that are in power would but hearken to their good advice. But Plato judged right that except kings themselves became philosophers, they who from their childhood are corrupted with false notions would never fall in entirely with the counsels of philosophers, and this he himself found to be true in the person of Dionysius. Do not you think that if I were about any king proposing good laws to him and endeavouring to root out all the cursed seeds of evil that I found in him, I should either be turned out of his court or at least be laughed at for my pains? For instance, what could it signify if I were about the King of France and were called into his cabinet council, where several wise men in his hearing were proposing many expedients as by what arts and practices Milan may be kept and Naples, that had so oft slipped out of their hands, recovered, how the Venetians and after them the rest of Italy may be subdued, and then how Flanders, Brabant, and all Burgundy, and some other kingdoms which he has swallowed already in his designs, may be added to his empire. One proposes a league with the Venetians to be kept as long as he finds his account in it, and that he ought to communicate counsels with them and give them some share of the spoil, till his success makes him need or fear them less, and then it will be easily taken out of their hands. Another proposes the hiring the Germans and the securing the Switzers by pensions. Another proposes the gaining the emperor by money, which is omnipotent with him. Another proposes a peace with the King of Aragon, and, in order to cement it, the yielding up of the King of Navarre's pretensions. Another thinks the Prince of Castile is to be wrought on by the hope of an alliance, and that some of his courtiers are to be gained to the French faction by pensions. The hardest point of all is what to do with England. A treaty of peace is to be set on foot, and if their alliance is not to be depended on, yet it is to be made as firm as possible. And they are to be called friends, but suspected as enemies. Therefore the Scots are to be kept in readiness, to be let loose upon England on every occasion, and some banished nobleman is to be supported underhand, for by the league it cannot be done avowedly, who has a pretension to the crown, by which means that suspected prince may be kept in awe. Now when things are in so great a fermentation, and so many gallant men are joining councils, how to carry on the war, if so mean a man as I should stand up, and wish them to change all their councils, to let Italy alone and stay at home, since the kingdom of France was indeed greater than could be well governed by one man, that therefore he ought not to think of adding others to it, and if after this I should propose to them the resolutions of the Achorians, a people that lie on the south-east of Utopia, who long ago engaged in war in order to add to the dominions of their prince another kingdom, to which he had some pretensions by an ancient alliance. This they conquered, but found that the trouble of keeping it was equal to that by which it was gained, that the conquered people were always either in rebellion or exposed to foreign invasions, while they were obliged to be incessantly at war, either for or against them, and consequently could never disband their army, that in the meantime they were oppressed with taxes, their money went out of the kingdom, their blood was spilt for the glory of their king, without procuring the least advantage to the people, who received not the smallest benefit from it even in time of peace, and that their manners being corrupted by a long war, robbery and murders everywhere abounded, and their laws fell into contempt, while their king, distracted with the care of two kingdoms, was the less able to apply his mind to the interests of either. When they saw this, and that there would be no end to these evils, they by joint counsels made an humble address to their king, desiring him to choose which of the two kingdoms he had the greatest mind to keep, since he could not hold both, for they were too great a people to be governed by a divided king, since no man would willingly have a groom that should be in common between him and another. upon which the good prince was forced to quit his new kingdom to one of his friends, who was not long after dethroned, and to be contented with his old one. To this I would add that after all those warlike attempts, the vast confusions, and the consumption both of treasure and of people that must follow them, perhaps upon some misfortune they might be forced to throw up all at last. Therefore it seemed much more eligible that the king should improve his ancient kingdom all he could, and make it flourish as much as possible, that he should love his people and be beloved of them, that he should live among them, govern them gently, and let other kingdoms alone, since that which had fallen to his share was big enough, if not too big for him. Pray, how do you think would such a speech as this be heard? I confess, said I think not very well. But what, said he, if I should sort with another kind of ministers, whose chief contrivances and consultations were, by what art the prince's treasures might be increased? Where one proposes raising the value of specie when the king's debts are large, and lowering it when his revenues were to come in, that so he might both pay much with a little, and in a little receive a great deal. Another proposes a pretence of a war, that money might be raised in order to carry it on, and that a peace be concluded as soon as that was done, and this with such appearances of religion as might work on the people and make them impute it to the piety of their prince and to his tenderness for the lives of his subjects. A third offers some old musty laws that have been antiquated by a long disuse, and which, as they had been forgotten by all the subjects, so they had been also broken by them, and proposes the levying the penalties of these laws, that as it would bring in a vast treasure, so there might be a very good pretence for it, since it would look like the executing a law and the doing of justice. A fourth proposes the prohibiting of many things under severe penalties, especially such as were against the interest of the people, and then the dispensing with these prohibitions upon great compositions to those who might find their advantage in breaking them. This would serve two ends, both of them acceptable to many, for as those whose avarice led them to transgress would be severely fined, so the selling licenses dear would look as if a prince were tender of his people, and would not easily, or at low rates, dispense with anything that might be against the public good. Another proposes that the judges must be made sure, that they may declare always in favour of the prerogative, that they must be often sent for to court, that the king may hear them argue those points in which he is concerned, since, how unjust soever any of his pretensions may be, yet still some one or other of them, either out of contradiction to others or the pride of singularity, or to make their court, would find out some pretence or other to give the king a fair colour to carry the point. For if the judges but differ in opinion, the clearest thing in the world is made by that means disputable, and truth being once brought in question, the king may then take advantage to expound the law for his own profit, while the judges that stand out will be brought over either out of fear or modesty, and they being thus gained, all of them may be sent to the bench to give sentence boldly, as the king would have it. For fair pretences will never be wanting when sentence is to be given in the prince's favour. It will either be said that equity lies on his side, or some words in the law will be found sounding that way, or some forced sense will be put on them. And when all other things fail, the king's undoubted prerogative will be pretended as that which is above all law, and to which a religious judge ought to have a special regard. Thus all consent to that maxim of Crassus, that a prince cannot have treasure enough, since he must maintain his armies out of it, that a king, even though he would, can do nothing unjustly, that all property is in him, not excepting the very persons of his subjects, and that no man has any other property but that which the king out of his goodness thinks fit to leave him. And they think it is the prince's interest that there be as little of this left as may be, as if it were his advantage that his people should have neither riches nor liberty, since these things make them less easy and less willing to submit to a cruel and unjust government, whereas necessity and poverty blunt them, make them patient, beat them down, and break that height of spirit that might otherwise dispose them to rebel. Now what if, after all these propositions were made, I should rise up and assert that such counsels were both unbecoming a king and mischievous to him, and that not only his honour but his safety consisted more in his people's wealth than in his own? If I should show that they choose a king for their own sake and not for his, that by his care and endeavours they may be both easy and safe, and that therefore a prince ought to take more care of his people's happiness than of his own, as a shepherd is to take more care of his flock than of himself. It is also certain that they are much mistaken that think the poverty of a nation is a means of the public safety. Who quarrel more than beggars? Who does more earnestly long for a change than he that is uneasy in his present circumstances? And who run to create confusions with so desperate a boldness as those who have nothing to lose hope to gain by them? If a king should fall under such contempt or envy that he could not keep his subjects in their duty, but by oppression and ill usage, and by rendering them poor and miserable, it were certainly better for him to quit his kingdom than to retain it by such methods as makes him, while he keeps the name of authority, lose the majesty due to it. Nor is it so becoming the dignity of a king to reign over beggars as over rich and happy subjects. And therefore Fabricius, a man of a noble and exalted temper, said he would rather govern rich men than be rich himself, since for one man to abound in wealth and pleasure, when all about him are mourning and groaning, is to a jailer and not a king. He is an unskilful physician that cannot cure one disease without casting his patient into another. So he that can find no other way for correcting the errors of his people, but by taking from them the conveniences of life, shows that he knows not what it is to govern a free nation. He himself ought rather to shake off his sloth or to lay down his pride, for the contempt or hatred that his people have for him takes its rise from the vices in himself. Let him live upon what belongs to him without wronging others, and accommodate his expense to his revenue. Let him punish crimes, and by his wise conduct let him endeavour to prevent them, rather than be severe when he has suffered them to be too common. Let him not rashly revive laws that are abrogated by disuse, especially if they have been long forgotten and never wanted. And let him never take any penalty for the breach of them, to which a judge would not give way in a private man, but would look on him as a crafty and unjust person for pretending to it. To these things I would add that law among the Macaronians, a people that live not far from Utopia, by which their king, on the day on which he begins to reign, is tied by an oath confirmed by solemn sacrifices, never to have at once above 1,000 pounds of gold in his treasures, or so much silver as is equal to that in value. This law, they tell us, was made by an excellent king, who had more regard to the riches of his country than to his own wealth, and therefore provided against the heaping up of so much treasure as might impoverish the people. He thought that a moderate sum might be sufficient for any accident, if either the king had occasion for it against rebels, or the kingdom against the invasion of an enemy, but that it was not enough to encourage a prince to invade other men's rights, a circumstance that was the chief cause of his making that law. He also thought that it was a good provision for that free circulation of money so necessary for the course of commerce and exchange, and when a king must distribute all those extraordinary accessions that increase treasure beyond the due pitch, it makes him less disposed to oppress his subjects. Such a king as this will be the terror of ill men, and will be beloved by all the good. If, I say, I should talk of these or such like things to men that had taken their bias another way, how deaf would they be to all I could say. "No doubt very deaf," answered I, "and no wonder, for one is never to offer at propositions or advice that we are certain will not be entertained. Discourses so much out of the road could not avail anything, nor have any effect on men whose minds were prepossessed with different sentiments. This philosophical way of speculation is not unpleasant among friends in a free conversation, but there is no room for it in the courts of princes, where great affairs are carried on by authority." "That is what I was saying," replied he, "that there is no room for philosophy in the courts of princes." "Yes, there is," said I, "but not for this speculative philosophy that makes everything to be alike fitting at all times. But there is another philosophy that is more pliable, that knows its proper scene, accommodates itself to it, and teaches a man with propriety and decency to act that part which has fallen to his share. If, when one of Plautus's comedies is upon the stage and a company of servants are acting their parts, you should come out in the garb of a philosopher and repeat out of Octavia a discourse of Seneca's to Nero, would it not be better for you to say nothing than by mixing things of such different natures to make an impertinent tragi-comedy? For you spoil and corrupt the play that is in hand when you mix with it things of an opposite nature, even though they are much better. Therefore, go through with the play that is acting the best you can, and do not confound it because another that is pleasanter comes into your thoughts. It is even so in a commonwealth and in the councils of princes. If ill opinions cannot be quite rooted out, and you cannot cure some received vice according to your wishes, you must not, therefore, abandon the commonwealth. For the same reasons, you should not forsake the ship in a storm because you cannot command the winds. You are not obliged to assault people with discourses that are out of their road, when you see that their received notions must prevent your making an impression upon them. You ought rather to cast about and to manage things with all the dexterity in your power, so that if you are not able to make them go well, they may be as little ill as possible. For except all men were good, everything cannot be right, and that is a blessing that I do not at present hope to see." "According to your arguments," answered he, "all that I could be able to do would be to preserve myself from being mad while I endeavour to cure the madness of others. For if I speak truth, I must repeat what I have said to you, and as for lying, whether a philosopher can do it or not, I cannot tell. I am sure I cannot do it. But though these discourses may be uneasy and ungrateful to them, I do not see why they should seem foolish or extravagant. Indeed, if I should either propose such things as Plato has contrived in his commonwealth, or as the Utopians practice in theirs, though they might seem better, as certainly they are, yet they are so different from our establishment, which is founded on property, there being no such thing among them, that I could not expect that it would have any effect on them. But such discourses as mine, which only call past evils to mind and give warning of what may follow, have nothing in them that is so absurd that they may not be used at any time, for they can only be unpleasant to those who are resolved to run headlong the contrary way. And if we must let alone everything as absurd or extravagant, which by reason of the wicked lives of many men seem uncouth, we must, even among Christians, give over pressing the greatest part of those things that Christ hath taught us, though he has commanded us not to conceal them, but to proclaim on the housetops that which he taught in secret. The greatest parts of his precepts are more opposite to the lives of the men of this age than any part of my discourse has been. But the preachers seem to have learned that craft to which you advise me, for they, observing that the world would not willingly suit their lives to the rules that Christ has given, have fitted his doctrine as if it had been a leaden rule to their lives, that so some way or other they might agree with one another. But I see no other effect of this compliance, except it be that men become more secure in their wickedness by it. And this is all the success that I can have in a court, for I must always differ from the rest, and then I shall signify nothing, or if I agree with them, I shall then only help forward their madness. I do not comprehend what you mean by your casting about, or by the bending and handling things so dexterously, that if they go not well, they may go as little ill as may be. For in courts they will not bear with a man's holding his peace or conniving at what others do. A man must barefacedly approve of the worst counsels, and consent to the blackest designs, so that he would pass for a spy, or possibly for a traitor, that did but coldly approve of such wicked practices. And therefore, when a man is engaged in such a society, he will be so far from being able to mend matters by his casting about, as you call it, that he will find no occasions of doing any good. The ill company will sooner corrupt him than be the better for him. Or if, notwithstanding all their ill company, he still remains steady and innocent, yet their follies and knavery will be imputed to him, and by mixing counsels with them he must bear his share of all the blame that belongs wholly to others. It was no ill simile by which Plato set forth the unreasonableness of a philosopher's meddling with government. If a man, says he, was to see a great company run out every day into the rain and take delight in being wet, if he knew that it would be to no purpose for him to go and persuade them to return to their houses in order to avoid the storm, and that all that could be expected by his going to speak to them would be that he himself should be as wet as they, it would be best for him to keep within doors, and since he had not influence enough to correct other people's folly, to take care to preserve himself. Though, to speak plainly my real sentiments, I must freely own that as long as there is any property, and while money is the standard of all other things, I cannot think that a nation can be governed either justly or happily. Not justly, because the best things will fall to the share of the worst men, nor happily, because all things will be divided among a few, and even these are not in all respects happy, the rest being left to be absolutely miserable. Therefore, when I reflect on the wise and good constitution of the Utopians, among whom all things are so well governed and with so few laws, where virtue hath its due reward, and yet there is such an equality that every man lives in plenty, when I compare with them so many other nations that are still making new laws, and yet can never bring their constitution to a right regulation, where notwithstanding everyone has his property, yet all the laws that they can invent have not the power either to obtain or preserve it, or even to enable men certainly to distinguish what is their own from what is another's, of which the many lawsuits that every day break out and are eternally depending give too plain a demonstration. When, I say, I balance all these things in my thoughts, I grow more favourable to Plato, and do not wonder that he resolved not to make any laws for such as would not submit to a community of all things. For so wise a man could not but foresee that the setting all upon a level was the only way to make a nation happy, which cannot be obtained so long as there is property. For when every man draws to himself all that he can compass, by one title or another, it must needs follow that how plentiful soever a nation may be, yet a few dividing the wealth of it among themselves, the rest must fall into indigence. So that there will be two sorts of people among them, who deserve that their fortunes should be interchanged, the former useless, but wicked and ravenous, and the latter, who by their constant industry serve the public more than themselves, sincere and modest men. From whence I am persuaded that till property is taken away, there can be no equitable or just distribution of things, nor can the world be happily governed. For as long as that is maintained, the greatest and the far best part of mankind will be still oppressed with a load of cares and anxieties. I confess, without taking it quite away, those pressures that lie on a great part of mankind may be made lighter, but they can never be quite removed, for if laws were made to determine at how great an extent in soil and at how much money every man must stop, to limit the prince that he might not grow too great, and to restrain the people that they might not become too insolent, and that none might factiously aspire to public employments, which ought neither to be sold nor made burdensome by a great expense, since otherwise those that serve in them would be tempted to reimburse themselves by cheats and violence, and it would become necessary to find out rich men for undergoing those employments which ought rather to be trusted to the wise. These laws, I say, might have such effects as good diet and care might have on a sick man whose recovery is desperate. They might allay and mitigate the disease, but it could never be quite healed, nor the body politic be brought again to a good habit, as long as property remains. And it will fall out as in a complication of diseases, that by applying a remedy to one sore you will provoke another, and that which removes the one ill symptom produces others, while the strengthening one part of the body weakens the rest. On the contrary, answered I, it seems to me that men cannot live conveniently where all things are common. How can there be any plenty where every man will excuse himself from labour? For as the hope of gain doth not excite him, so the confidence that he has in other men's industry may make him slothful. If people come to be pinched with want, and yet cannot dispose of anything as their own, what can follow upon this but perpetual sedition and bloodshed, especially when the reverence and authority due to magistrates fall to the ground? For I cannot imagine how that can be kept up among those that are in all things equal to one another. I do not wonder, said he, that it appears so to you, since you have no notion, or at least no right one, of such a constitution. But if you had been in a utopia with me, and had seen their laws and rules as I did, for the space of 5 years in which I lived among them, and during which time I was so delighted with them that indeed I should never have left them if it had not been to make the discovery of that new world to the Europeans, you would then confess that you had never seen a people so well constituted as they. You will not easily persuade me, said Peter, that any nation in that new world is better governed than those among us. For as our understandings are not worse than theirs, so our government, if I mistake not, being more ancient, a long practice that has helped us to find out many conveniences of life, and some happy chances have discovered other things to us which no man's understanding could ever have invented. As for the antiquity, either of their government or of ours, said he, you cannot pass a true judgment of it unless you had read their histories. For if they are to be believed, they had towns among them before these parts were so much as inhabited. And as for those discoveries that have been either hit on by chance or made by ingenious men, these might have happened there as well as here. I do not deny, but we are more ingenious than they are, but they exceed us much in industry and application. They knew little concerning us before our arrival among them. They call us all by a general name of the nations that lie beyond the equinoctial line, for their chronicle mentions a shipwreck that was made on their coast 1,200 years ago, and that some Romans and Egyptians that were in the ship, getting safe ashore, spent the rest of their days among them. And such was their ingenuity that from this single opportunity they drew the advantage of learning from those unlooked-for guests, and acquired all the useful arts that were then among the Romans, and which were known to these shipwrecked men. And by the hints that they gave them, they themselves found out even some of those arts which they could not fully explain. So happily did they improve that accident of having some of our people cast upon their shore. But if such an accident has at any time brought any from thence into Europe, we have been so far from improving it that we do not so much as remember it, as in after times perhaps it will be forgot by our people that I was ever there. For though they from one such accident made themselves masters of all the good inventions that were among us, yet I believe it would be long before we should learn or put in practice any of the good institutions that are among them. And this is the true cause of their being better governed, and living happier than we, though we come not short of them in point of understanding or outward advantages. Upon this I said to him, I earnestly beg you would describe that island very particularly to us. Be not too short, but set out in order all things relating to their soil, their rivers, their towns, their people, their manners, constitution, laws, and, in a word, all that you imagine we desire to know. And you may well imagine that we desire to know everything concerning them, of which we are hitherto ignorant. "I will do it very willingly," said he, "for I have digested the whole matter carefully, but it will take up some time." "Let us go then," said I, "first and dine, and then we shall have leisure enough." He consented. We went in and dined, and after dinner came back and sat down in the same place. I ordered my servants to take care that none might come and interrupt us, and both Peter and I desired Raphael to be as good as his word. When he saw that we were very intent upon it, he paused a little to recollect himself and began in this manner. Book 2. The island of Utopia is in the middle 200 miles broad, and holds almost at the same breadth over a great part of it. But it grows narrower toward both ends. Its figure is not unlike a crescent. Between its horns the sea comes in 11 miles broad, and spreads itself into a great bay, which is environed with land to the compass of about 500 miles, and is well secured from winds. In this bay there is no great current. The whole coast is, as it were, one continued harbour, which gives all that live in the island great convenience for mutual commerce. But the entry into the bay, occasioned by rocks on the one hand and shallows on the other, is very dangerous. In the middle of it there is one single rock, which appears above water, and may therefore be easily avoided, and on the top of it there is a tower in which a garrison is kept. The other rocks lie under water and are very dangerous. The channel is known only to the natives, so that if any stranger should enter into the bay without one of their pilots, he would run great danger of shipwreck, for even they themselves could not pass it safe, if some marks that are on the coast did not direct their way. And if these should be but a little shifted, any fleet that might come against them, how great soever it were, would be certainly lost. On the other side of the island there are likewise many harbours, and the coast is so fortified, both by nature and art, that a small number of men can hinder the descent of a great army. But they report, and there remain good marks of it to make it credible, that this was no island at first, but a part of the continent. Eutopus, that conquered it, whose name it still carries, for Abraxa was its first name, brought the rude and uncivilized inhabitants into such a good government, and to that measure of politeness, that they now far excel all the rest of mankind. Having soon subdued them, he designed to separate them from the continent, and to bring the sea quite round them. To accomplish this, he ordered a deep channel to be dug 15 miles long, and that the natives might not think he treated them like slaves, he not only forced the inhabitants, but also his own soldiers, to labour in carrying it on. As he set a vast number of men to work, he beyond all men's expectations brought it to a speedy conclusion, and his neighbours, who at first laughed at the folly of the undertaking, no sooner saw it brought to perfection than they were struck with admiration and terror. There are 54 cities in the island, all large and well built, the manners, customs, and laws of which are the same, and they are all contrived as near in the same manner as the ground on which they stand will allow. The nearest lie at least 24 miles distance from one another, and the most remote are not so far distant but that a man can go on foot in one day from it to that which lies next to it. Every city sends 3 of its wisest senators once a year to Amorot to consult about their common concerns, for that is the chief town of the island, being situated near the centre of it, so that it is the most convenient place for their assemblies. The jurisdiction of every city extends at least 20 miles, and where the towns lie wider, they have much more ground. No town desires to enlarge its bounds, for the people consider themselves rather as tenants than landlords. They have built over all the country farmhouses for husbandmen, which are well contrived, and are furnished with all things necessary for country labour. Inhabitants are sent by turns from the cities to dwell in them. No country family has fewer than 40 men and women in it, besides 2 slaves. There is a master and a mistress set over every family, and over 30 families there is a magistrate. Every year 20 of this family come back to the town after they have stayed 2 years in the country, and in their room there are other 20 sent from the town, that they may learn country work from those that have been already 1 year in the country, as they must teach those that come to them the next from the town. By this means, such as dwell in those country farms are never ignorant of agriculture, and so commit no errors which might otherwise be fatal, and bring them under a scarcity of corn. But though there is every year such a shifting of the husbandman to prevent any man being forced against his will to follow that hard course of life too long, yet many among them take such pleasure in it that they desire leave to continue in it many years. These husbandmen till the ground, breed cattle, hew wood, and convey it to the towns, either by land or water, as is most convenient. They breed an infinite multitude of chickens in a very curious manner, for the hens do not sit and hatch them, but vast numbers of eggs are laid in a gentle and equal heat in order to be hatched, and they are no sooner out of the shell and able to stir about, but they seem to consider those that feed them as their mothers, and follow them as other chickens do the hen that hatched them. They breed very few horses, but those they have are full of mettle and are kept only for exercising their youth in the art of sitting and riding them, for they do not put them to any work either of ploughing or carriage, in which they employ oxen. For though their horses are stronger, yet they find oxen can hold out longer, and as they are not subject to so many diseases, so they are kept upon a less charge and with less trouble, and even when they are so worn out that they are no more fit for labour, they are good meat at last. They sow no corn, but that which is to be their bread, for they drink either wine, cider, or perry, and often water, sometimes boiled with honey or licorice, with which they abound. And though they know exactly how much corn will serve every town, and all that tract of country which belongs to it, yet they sow much more, and breed more cattle than are necessary for their consumption, and they give that overplus of which they make no use to their neighbours. When they want anything in the country which it does not produce, they fetch that from the town, without carrying anything in exchange for it, and the magistrates of the town take care to see it given them, for they meet generally in the town once a month upon a festival day. When the time of harvest comes, the magistrates in the country send to those in the towns and let them know how many hands they will need for reaping the harvest, and the number they call for being sent to them, they commonly dispatch it all in 1 day. Book 2. Of their towns, particularly of Amorot. He that knows one of their towns knows them all, they are so like one another, except where the situation makes some difference. I shall therefore describe one of them, and none is so proper as Amorot, for as none is more eminent, all the rest yielding in precedence to this, because it is the seat of their supreme council, so there was none of them better known to me, I having lived 5 years altogether in it. It lies upon the side of a hill, or rather a rising ground. Its figure is almost square, for from the one side of it, which shoots up almost to the top of the hill, it runs down in a descent for 2 miles to the river Anida, but it is a little broader the other way that runs along by the bank of that river. The Anida rises about 80 miles above Amorot, in a small spring at first, but other brooks falling into it, of which 2 are more considerable than the rest. As it runs by Amorot, it is grown 1/2 mile broad, but it still grows larger and larger, till after 60 miles course below it, it is lost in the ocean, between the town and the sea, and for some miles above the town it ebbs and flows every 6 hours with a strong current. The tide comes up for about 30 miles, so full that there is nothing but salt water in the river, the fresh water being driven back with its force, and above that, for some miles, the water is brackish, but a little higher, as it runs by the town, it is quite fresh, and when the tide ebbs, it continues fresh all along to the sea. There is a bridge cast over the river, not of timber, but of fair stone, consisting of many stately arches. It lies at that part of the town which is farthest from the sea, so that ships without any hindrance lie all along the side of the town. There is likewise another river that runs by it, which, though it is not great, yet it runs pleasantly, for it rises out of the same hill on which the town stands, and so runs down through it and falls into the Oneida. The inhabitants have fortified the fountainhead of this river, which springs a little without the town, so that if they should happen to be besieged, the enemy might not be able to stop or divert the course of the water, nor poison it. From thence it is carried in earthen pipes to the lower streets, and for those places of the town to which the water of that shallow river cannot be conveyed, they have great cisterns for receiving the rainwater which supplies the want of the other. The town is compassed with a high and thick wall, in which there are many towers and forts. There is also a broad and deep dry ditch, set thick with thorns, cast round three sides of the town, and the river is instead of a ditch on the fourth side. The streets are very convenient for all carriage, and are well sheltered from the winds. Their buildings are good, and are so uniform that a whole side of a street looks like one house. The streets are 20 feet broad. There lie gardens behind all their houses. These are large, but enclosed with buildings that on all hands face the streets, so that every house has both a door to the street and a back door to the garden. Their doors have all two leaves, which, as they are easily opened, so they shut of their own accord, and there being no property among them, every man may freely enter into any house whatsoever. At every 10 years' end they shift their houses by lots. They cultivate their gardens with great care, so that they have vines, fruits, herbs, and flowers in them, and all is so well ordered and so finely kept that I never saw gardens anywhere that were both so fruitful and so beautiful as theirs. And this humour of ordering their gardens so well is not only kept up by the pleasure they find in it, but also by an emulation between the inhabitants of the several streets, who vie with each other, and there is indeed nothing belonging to the whole town that is both more useful and more pleasant. So that he who founded the town seems to have taken care of nothing more than of their gardens. For they say the whole scheme of the town was designed at first by Eutopus, but he left all that belonged to the ornament and improvement of it to be added by those that should come after him, that being too much for one man to bring to perfection. Their records, that contain the history of their town and state, are preserved with an exact care, and run backward 1,760 years. From these it appears that their houses were at first low and mean, like cottages, made of any sort of timber, and were built with mud walls and thatched with straw. But now their houses are three stories high, the fronts of them are faced with stone, plastering, or brick, and between the facings of their walls they throw in their rubbish. Their roofs are flat, and on them they lay a sort of plaster which costs very little, and yet is so tempered that it is not apt to take fire, and yet resists the weather more than lead. They have great quantities of glass among them, with which they glaze their windows. They use also in their windows a thin linen cloth that is so oiled or gummed that it both keeps out the wind and gives free admission to the light. Book 2. Of Their Magistrates. 30 families choose every year a magistrate who was anciently called the Siphograant, but is now called the Phylarch, and over every 10 Siphograants, with the families subject to them, there is another magistrate who was anciently called the Tranibor, but of late the Archphilarch. All the Siphograants, who are in number 200, choose the prince out of a list of 4, who are named by the people of the 4 divisions of the city. But they take an oath before they proceed to an election that they will choose him whom they think most fit for the office. They give their voices secretly, so that it is not known for whom everyone gives his suffrage. The prince is for life, unless he is removed upon suspicion of some design to enslave the people. The Tranibors are new chosen every year, but yet they are for the most part continued. All their other magistrates are only annual. The Trannibals meet every third day, and oftener, if necessary, and consult with the prince either concerning the affairs of the state in general, or such private differences as may arise sometimes among the people. Though that falls out but seldom. There are always two Sifagrants called into the council chamber, and these are changed every day. It is a fundamental rule of their government that no conclusion can be made in anything that relates to the public till it has been first debated three several days in their council. It is death for any to meet and consult concerning the state, unless it be either in their ordinary council or in the assembly of the whole body of the people. These things have been so provided among them that the prince and the Trannibors may not conspire together to change the government and enslave the people, and therefore when anything of great importance is set on foot, it is sent to the Sifagrants, who, after they have communicated it to the families that belong to their divisions, and have considered it among themselves, make report to the Senate, and upon great occasions the matter is referred to the council of the whole island. One rule observed in their council is never to debate a thing on the same day in which it is first proposed, for that is always referred to the next meeting, that so men may not rashly and in the heat of discourse engage themselves too soon, which might bias them so much that instead of consulting the good of the public, they might rather study to support their first opinions, and by a perverse and preposterous sort of shame, hazard their country rather than endanger their own reputation, or venture the being suspected to have wanted foresight in the expedients that they at first proposed. And therefore, to prevent this, they take care that they may rather be deliberate than sudden in their motions. Book 2. Of Their Trades and Manner of Life. Agriculture is that which is so universally understood among them that no person, either man or woman, is ignorant of it. They are instructed in it from their childhood, partly by what they learn at school and partly by practice, they being led out often into the fields about the town, where they not only see others at work, but are likewise exercised in it themselves. Besides agriculture, which is so common to them all, every man has some peculiar trade to which he applies himself, such as the manufacture of wool or flax, masonry, smith's work or carpenter's work, for there is no sort of trade that is not in great esteem among them. Throughout the island they wear the same sort of clothes without any other distinction, except what is necessary to distinguish the two sexes and the married and unmarried. The fashion never alters, and as it is neither disagreeable nor uneasy, so it is suited to the climate and calculated both for their summers and winters. Every family makes their own clothes, but all among them, women as well as men, learn one or other of the trades formerly mentioned. Women, for the most part, deal in wool and flax, which suit best with their weakness, leaving the ruder trades to the men. The same trade generally passes down from father to son, inclinations often following descent. But if any man's genius lies another way, he is, by adoption, translated into a family that deals in the trade to which he is inclined. And when that is to be done, care is taken not only by his father, but by the magistrate, that he may be put to a discreet and good man. And if after a person has learned one trade, he desires to acquire another, that is also allowed, and is managed in the same manner as the former. When he has learned both, he follows that which he likes best, unless the public has more occasion for the other. The chief, and almost the only business, of the Sifagrants is to take care that no man may live idle, but that every one may follow his trade diligently. Yet they do not wear themselves out with perpetual toil from morning to night, as if they were beasts of burden, which, as it is indeed a heavy slavery, so it is everywhere the common course of life among all mechanics except the Utopians. But they, dividing the day and night into 24 hours, appoint 6 of these for work, 3 of which are before dinner and 3 after. They then sup, and at 8 o'clock, counting from noon, go to bed and sleep 8 hours. The rest of their time, besides that taken up in work, eating and sleeping, is left to every man's discretion. Yet they are not to abuse that interval to luxury and idleness, but must employ it in some proper exercise according to their various inclinations, which is, for the most part, reading. It is ordinary to have public lectures every morning before daybreak, at which none are obliged to appear but those who are marked out for literature. Yet a great many, both men and women of all ranks, go to hear lectures of one sort or other, according to their inclinations. But if others, that are not made for contemplation, choose rather to employ themselves at that time in their trades, as many of them do, they are not